topic session number 9590, Reel 1.
Mr. Duffield, Reel 1. Where were you born, Mr. Duffield?
I was born in Middlesbrough, in North Yorkshire. It's now Cleveland.
What did your father do for a living?
Well, my father was a fruiterer. In other words, he was a hawker. He sold fruit from a handcart.
So he was self-employed?
That is right, yeah. Because he couldn't get work after the war, when he came out from the war.
What kind of education did you have?
I had an elementary education, but at the age of 11 I got what was called a central education in that particular area. It's a school of the quality of a grammar school, but somewhere in between the two.
You were telling me earlier that there were very few 11 plus places in those days.
Yeah, very few. As I was saying early on, there was only one place in Middlesbrough that would, from a scholarship to the grammar school. So you didn't have a great deal of opportunity in that direction. Not if you were, the ordinary working class.
And I think you said that you knew the one chap who got that grammar school.
Yes, he was a Mr. Matthias, and he eventually became a teacher at this particular school.
So how old were you when you left school?
Well, I left school at the age of 15.
To do what?
And then I enlisted in the Air Force as an apprentice, which was really like, you might say, continuing going to school, because for the next 3 years I went to an Air Force training school where they continue with your education both in school and also in workshops where you learn the practical aspects. So you still went on learning mathematics and history and geography and things like that for the next 3 years, but it was all directed in a particular way towards the needs of the service.
I think this was Halton.
Halton in Buckinghamshire, yes.
Why did you decide to go in for the RAF?
Well, it really boils down to the fact that when I was going to school, there was two friends of mine had joined the Air Force the year before, and after they'd enlisted, they went to Halton, and then they'd come back to visit the school. And when I saw these lads in this nice uniform, and they looked so impressed on me, it sort of fired up my ambition to do something similar. I really wanted to be a pilot. I never ever became a pilot, by the way, but that's what I wanted to be. It wouldn't have been possible for me to become a pilot in those days, because I'm short-sighted. Nevertheless, I still became aircrew, as you well know. But in those days, I wanted to be a pilot, and I saw these chaps in this nice uniform, and I thought, well, that looks like a nice little job to do, you know. And you must bear in mind, my father had been in the army during the war, and my uncles were in the Territorial Army at that time. And so the idea of a service life was quite attractive to me. And I thought, well, this would be a good job to do. And I spoke with them, and they told me they were having a good time. In point of fact, they wouldn't have been, but that's what they told me. Because when you first go to Halton, discipline's very hard on you. In those days it was, anyway. And you don't really enjoy your first year.
What line did you take up in Halton?
I was taught to be two trades. I was taught to be, what was called to be training to be a fitter too, which is I learned to be an engine fitter, and also at the same time concurrent with to be an aircraft fitter. In other words, in the old days it could be two people. Now they're going to do it with one, part of the economies of the Air Force. Actually, in the fullness of time, that never really came to anything, because the war destroyed the idea. They stopped training fitter twos after a fair while. Yeah.
What did the work actually involve?
Well, the work was really in the servicing of aircraft. In those days, servicing was a more complex thing. The aircraft was simpler, but you did more. In other words, we would do the daily maintenance on the engines and aircraft, but we'd do all the intermediate maintenance, and also we'd do the full final overhauls of the aircraft and the engine to keep it servicing. So normally you'd expect to partake in the general running of the technical side of a squadron of aircraft.
But I think that during the war that you trained to become a flight engineer.
Yes. At the very beginning of the war, there was an airman's order which asked for volunteers to fly on the new bombers they're expecting to get. And I saw this, and you had to be of my trade to be able to do the job, so I volunteered, as did all my friends of the same trade. And, you know, ex-Halton boys like me, we all volunteered in mass. But nothing happened. This would be, of course, in early 1940, when this AMO came out, and I never heard any more about it. But later on, when I was serving overseas in 1942, I got a letter saying, did I still wish to become a flight engineer? And if I did, I could come home. So I promptly said I did and went home. Because they were just then starting to get the aircraft. I remember when I first started training, they didn't have any Lancasters when I first started training, but they came along as my training progressed.
Why did you put in to be a flight engineer in the first place?
Well, mainly because it seemed applicable to what I was able to do. You know, I already was a fitter and understood the aircraft in fullness in itself, and so it wouldn't be very hard for me to do it. Right? But also, of course, the war was on, and I was a very patriotic person, as I am now, and I felt that I would play a fuller part in taking more direct sort of action in the war. In other words, to go and do some of the fighting that other people were doing on my behalf, as it were. And I thought it was time that I was doing some of it, to contribute more.
But ground crew didn't feel a sense of shame, did they?
Oh, not at all, because you always realise when you were ground crew, you were just as essential to the role as anybody else, right? But in the Air Force, you always felt, at least I did, that the direct role in the war was that undertook by the air crew, who were actually, you know, the ones that went where the fighting was. Because sometimes, you understand, depending where you're stationed, the ground crew could be very directly involved, because the airfields could be, especially fighter squadrons, they'd be quite close to front lines and were subject to as much as the war as anybody else. Yeah. But if you're on a bomber squadron, yeah, you're a long way from the war, generally speaking. Where if you're air crew, you were going to get to it and do something.
When the war broke out, did it take you by surprise, or had you expected it?
It didn't take me by surprise, because when I'd trained at Halton, they directed our thoughts at that stage. The point was, I remember having to write an essay on Nazi Germany, and to do this, it involved a lot of reading in relation to that. And I'd already read Mein Kampf, and I'd already read Gunther's Inside Europe. And if you read Gunther's Inside Europe this day, you will find out he's telling you what's going to happen. And I'd read many other books in direction of what was going to happen in Europe. And so I was aware of the possibilities that are going on. Because I wasn't that clever, I would know exactly when the war was going to start. But I knew from within the service, because I already knew of the expansion that had taken place in the Air Force. People are very commonly deride Chamberlain. You know, he's much politically criticised. Well, he might have been a bad politician, I don't know that. But I do know he'd set in foot all this expansion within the forces, and they were then rapidly building up these various units within the Air Force, and also, as I found out later, the shadow factories that went with it. And Neckenfield, of course, was an expansion airfield. And when I got there and I saw what was going on there to build up the Air Force, and I see the change that were taking place already in the types of aircraft we were getting, then I knew the war was imminent.
When Chamberlain declared that we were at war with Germany, mm-hmm. were you dismayed, or what? What was your reaction?
Well, I was young. And young men are never dismayed by the thought of war. No. Because to young men, as opposed to the older man, you think of it as an adventure. And of course, we were always very sure that we would win, like all Englishmen. We usually are sure of things without having any good reason to be sure of it, because we really didn't know what we were fighting, because we were, in reality, we were not so well prepared as all that, were we? Because so much had been let go by the politicians in the years that it took place before. Because there's all this defence cutting that had gone on, it reduced the services to nothing. The Air Force was only 20,000 men at the start of the war, in total strength.
But you personally felt confident?
Oh yes, I did, yeah.
Now, can you tell me which, once you qualified as a flight engineer, which squadron you went to?
Well, I was posted to, well, initially I went to 101 Squadron, but they didn't have any Lancasters. They still had Whitley, Wellington, sorry. You know? And then I was then transferred from 101 Squadron, and I went to a training camp at Hatfield near Doncaster, where the Lancasters had now appeared, and joined a crew and trained on Lancasters there. But the crew I was flying with were an Australian crew, and I was going to go to 430 Squadron, an Australian squadron. But our crew got into trouble for low flying, and they disbanded the crew, and they reduced the flight sergeant pilot to an LAC and split the crew up. And then I was sent to 103 Squadron at Elsham Wold, where I then joined the flight commander's crew there, because he'd fallen out with his flight engineer.
So the Australians had been flying low in the Hatfield area, hadn't they?
Yes, we went through a tree, in point of fact, because we got so enthusiastic about this low flying. And we couldn't say we hadn't been through a tree, because the branch of the engine that were impaled in our radiator, and it, because I'd had to shut the engine down because all the coolant had gone. And so when we landed, we had all these twigs and branches sticking out the front of the port outer engine. So we were a bit put. He got court-martialed, actually. I remember we all went to court-martial. And as a crew, we banded together and we got up some story as to how we could have done this. And it was all lies, of course. And they took us in individually in there. And later on, the pilot said, I said, what's you blokes coming in there to lie for me? He said, and each one of you in turn, as the prosecuting officer got onto you, he twisted you around so much, he says, in the end, you were condemning me all the time. Because, you know, we were, for instance, I went and said, well, we were just flying along, we were in cloud, and all of a sudden we broke cloud, and there was this hill with a tree on it. No, well, of course, we were not doing that at all. We were just, because we used to love low flying, but it was banned, you see, mainly because the civil population used to moan about it. And, of course, it was also highly dangerous.
Who was court-martialed then? You and the rest?
No, just the captain. They decided to make an example of the captain. I might tell you, the captain, although he was reduced the rank of LAC, he finished the war as a squadron leader, and highly decorated too.
What was his name?
I've just forgotten his name for the moment. I can tell you later on. Yeah.
So why did you like low flying? Because of
it's
the
exhilarating. When you first start to fly, it's very exhilarating because you get this sense of speed as you go across the ground, and we used to think that was fun. I wouldn't think so now, by the way. I'd be terrified.
Which year was this that this incident with low flying occurred?
Which year?
Yes.
This would be in 1942. That's it, you know, it would be around about October of that year. Russell Marks was the name of the pilot, an Australian, came from Brisbane.
How do you spell Marks?
M-A-R-K-S.
What were the Australians like? Were they different from English people?
Oh yeah, they have a totally different outlook. And they're great fun, actually, Australians. You've got to remember, they're very sort of, they always appear to English as rude and blunt people, but they're not. They only sound like that. They're very thoughtful and caring people. But they used to always call me that bloody Pom, because I was the Englishman, you see. And but they were just as... We always did everything together, because if you were a crew, you generally did. And they were good for... But they're very quarrelsome people among themselves, I notice. They seem to get upset easily about small things, which the more phlegmatic Englishman doesn't do. And I was always having to get between them to separate them from hitting each other. I once had to separate the navigator and the pilot while we were flying, because the pilot got mad because the navigator had told the signaller to get a bearing, because the navigator wasn't actually sure of his position at the time. And the pilot said, you shouldn't tell the signaller to ask for a bearing unless I tell you, because the pilot took this as a personal insult to himself. And the next minute they wanted to start fighting, and I had to stop them. I said, it's a good idea if we just fly the aeroplane.
Were they more reckless than English people?
Oh yes. I would say Australian and Chinese people have a slightly more openly courageous of those. The England's got Englishman's quiet in his courage, because, you know, everybody's a coward, as you know. I mean, there's no such thing as brave men. At least there may be, but they must be foolhardy. And everybody's a coward in one way or another. But the Australians are not quite as cautious as we are in that sense, you know.
Did you like them?
Oh yes, I was very fond of them.
And this was this was 101 Squadron, was it?
No, we'd not got to. I was still at this unit at Hatfield near Doncaster, where we were training, and when he was court martialed, and after he was court martialed, I was sent to 101 to join the crew of Squadron Leader Powdrow.
Squadron Leader
Powdrow.
How do you spell that?
Powdrell.
Which squadron were you with when you first did operations?
With 103 Squadron. I think I've confused myself there slightly. Squadron Leader Powdrow was on 103, that's where I was sent.
And that was in Lincolnshire, was it?
As in Lincolnshire, yeah. Elsham Wold.
Whereabouts?
It's near Scunthorpe. The airfield doesn't exist anymore, it's just the fields now.
Can you tell me something about the makeup of 103 Squadron?
Well, 103 Squadron was a squadron equipped with Lancaster aircraft at that time. And like all squadrons, they would have 8 aircraft in it. There was another squadron on the station, which was 166, I think. And the squadron commander was at that time was a Wing Commander Carter, who I later on knew as an Air Vice Marshal, and then he became an Air Marshal. And he was an ex-apprentice like myself, because I remember when I joined the squadron, I reported into him, and he said to me, "You're an ex-apprentice," and I said, "Yes." He says, "Right, I'll put you down on the list for Christmas leave." And so it was very hard to get Christmas leave in the war, but I got it, mainly because the apprentices tended to look after each other. It was like a club within the Air Force, and still is.
And how many Lancasters were in the squadron?
About 8 Lancasters on a squadron.
What was the...
They changed very quickly, by the way. They didn't ever run short of aeroplanes. Remember, the attrition rate was large. Yeah. I mean, you only lasted about 6 weeks on a squadron, generally.
What was the air base like at Elsham Wold?
Well, it was a very large airfield that had been constructed on the site, you know, and there was about 4 hangars had been built. The accommodation was all dispersed. In other words, the accommodation was not at the main site of the airfield. It was always off in the fields. And I remember I lived in a hut about 2 miles from where I had to go to the squadron site. And the squadron site was dispersed in the airfield in turn. We used to get around on bicycles. You used to get issued with a bicycle so you could move around freely. But I was lucky in that I was on the flight commander's crew, and he used to have a transport of his own. He would come and collect us wherever we wanted to go on the camp.
Was Elsham Wold ever attacked by the Luftwaffe?
Not when I was there.
Can you tell me how many operations you flew approximately from Elsham Wold?
I only flew 6 operations from Elsham Wold.
Where to?
Well, the first 2 I did to Essen. This is in the Ruhr. And then I did 2 to Berlin. And then I did 1 to Lorient in France. And the last one I did was to Milan in Italy.
Can you tell me about the role that you actually performed in the aircraft, what you actually did?
Well, the engineer, generally speaking, was responsible for the running of the engines, as you might say, and all the mechanical things appertaining on the aircraft. You had to act in the wartime role, because they didn't want to waste too many pilots. You had to act as a sort of a temporary second pilot. All this amounted to was that your pilot, whoever you're with, used to teach on the ground in a link trainer the rudiments of flying an aircraft, roughly. And then he taught you to fly the aircraft straight and level in flight. And I remember Squadron Leader Powden, he laid on a special trip with me so he could teach me to fly straight and level. And then my instructions were very simple, that if he was wounded or killed, incapacitated in any way, then all I had to do was to turn the aircraft through 180 degrees, because generally speaking that would bring us back, and he says, and eventually you'll get back to Britain, and when you get back, order the crew to jump out and allow the aircraft to crash. And that was what my instructions were in that respect.
Did you ever have to do that?
No, thank the Lord. I had friends who have had to do that. I had one friend who did it twice. But he ignored his captain's instructions because his captain wouldn't have been able to jump out in both cases. And he actually landed the aircraft at the emergency airfield at Woodford. There's a big airfield for crashing on. There was two of them, actually. But he landed at Woodford in both cases.
Whereabouts in the Lancaster would you sit?
The Lancaster had dual controls at the front, and I sat in the right-hand seat next to the pilot. So when you flew, you operated the throttles as you took off and set the power settings. And any power changes thereafter, the engineer, you also raised the undercarriage when the pilot told you to do and set the flaps and so on. And you kept a close eye on all the engine operating conditions on the gauges. You controlled the fuel. You know, the fuel was carried in the main planes. Some tanks you had to transfer to ultimately use the fuel. So you had to make sure, because you had room to transfer, because on a Lancaster, you could pump your fuel overboard if you tried to do it too early. And that would have been a disaster, because you wouldn't have got where you were going. And so you controlled the fuel of the system. You controlled the engine temperatures, because you had little radiator flaps which controlled the airflow in the radiator. But you had to control them with a small electrical switch, so you kept your eye on these temperatures.
A small which switch?
A small electrical control switch for each engine.
What were the main problems in the Lancaster as far as your own particular job was concerned?
The Lancasters, when you were flying in them, the Lancasters when you were flying in them were brand new. And so they didn't seem to have very many mechanical problems, really. And I only experienced one flight where the engine started overheat. And I had one engine overheat and I had to shut the engine down. And we were going actually to bomb the Ruhr at the time. And so we weren't going to get there because we were losing height. And I suggest the pilot we went and took an alternative target and went and bombed a channel port, and which he was keen to do. I noticed the married men on the crew weren't so keen, but he was. And we set forth, and then I had to shut another engine down then, and then we lost height very rapidly. And as we went through 6,000 feet, we had to drop our bombs in the sea to reduce the weight of the aircraft to steer, and then fly back on two engines. So we had to abandon the operation, in other words.
What was the cause of the engine failure?
There was coolant leakage in one of the engines.
How had that come about?
Were just bad maintenance, I suppose. Yeah.
Was that the fault of the ground crew?
Not directly. You couldn't say it was a fault on their part, because leakage on coolant could happen any time. You know, but generally speaking, they should be very careful to check for no leaks before you take off.
So your job on board the Lancaster was straightforward, usually, was it?
Oh, yes. It was a very simple job.
What mark of Lancaster was it? Do you remember?
That was the Lancaster Mark I.
Can you describe what it was like, being in the Lancaster?
In what you mean, in sense?
From the point of view of comfort. And no,
the Lancaster is a very awkward aeroplane to get into for a crew. As you entered from a door at the rear, and you had to traverse the fuselage, and first of all you had to climb over a large section of fuselage where the bomb compartment housed in, and this reduced the available height for you. And then you had to climb over the main centre section. Now, if you remember, you were all wrapped. There was no heating to speak of in the Lancaster, and so you had this very heavy flying clothing on. You also had a parachute harness on, and you were carrying a parachute when you went up forward. And you had to climb over this centre section, and this used to be very, very difficult. And it used to exhaust me, to be quite honest. And then, of course, you got sat in your seat, and once you got sat in your seat, you strapped yourself in, and there you were, you know. And once you climbed in altitude, then the aircraft got progressively colder and colder. And when you got to about 20,000 feet in the winter months when I was flying, the temperature outside was about minus 52. And it wasn't a great deal warmer inside. And although we were well dressed, I used to find your hands in the end would start to feel cold, and so would your feet. And you used to have to keep on exercising your feet to try and pretend you were going to get warm. Down at the the only chap that would be warm would be the signaller, because the air, there's some warm air ducted from the inboard engines used to come across the centre section there, and that would warm slightly that part of the Lancaster, and it was the only warm place there was. The poor old bomb air was stuck in the front, he would be freezing to death, and so would be the bloke in the mid upper turret. It would not be warm.
So you went clothed with all kinds of very warm clothing.
That's it. You were issued with this fur lined jackets and special flying clothing. And the chap in the rear turret, he used to have an electrically heated flying suit. He plugged in down in the rear turret, and that would warm him. But that was the only place to add that facility, because they really needed it.
Did you find this warm clothing was effective?
Yes, it saved you getting frostbite and things like that. But you still were cold. And you had to sit there, you know, for a fair number of hours doing your flying.
What if you wanted to urinate?
Well, that was... We did this... There was... Up the front, there were small little special bags with a special that you could urinate in. What we used to do, in point of fact, we used to take a milk bottle along with us. And we'd urinate in that. And it wasn't a good idea to pour the urine out through the side window, because that used to freeze straight on the mid of a turret. So we used to sling the bottle straight out.
As far as you could?
Yeah, and get rid of it. Well, throw it down, you know.
Now, you've talked about the dangers. Were people very frightened before they took off?
People used to be tense. Because you remember, you went, before you ever done, there was a long briefing that went on to explain your target and what your role was, what you were trying to do. And this would get you in a nice tense frame of mind for a start off, wouldn't it? And by the time you got to the aircraft, then you'll be reasonably tensed up about it.
Did people have superstitions about...
Well, not on my crew. I suppose the signaler was the chap who was the most tense. Because he was on his second tour of operations. He'd done 30 operations on one tour, and now he's in his second tour at his 11th of that. And so he used to be very nervous during the operations.
How did that show itself?
Well, he always used to shake a little bit, and he used to sweat very easily, and his voice wasn't quite the same as when he normally, so it was all sort of clipped. But he knew that he was tense, and he used to talk about it. And he knew he was afraid.
What was the name of your pilot?
That was Squad Leader Powdell. W.H. Powdell. And he was a very brave man. He'd done 11 operations on a previous tour when he'd crashed in this... the aircraft had been damaged considerably, and he'd crashed in this country. Then he spent a long time in hospital. And now he'd returned to operations, and now he's on his 11th. He's on his 11th operation. That was when I first joined him, of the second tour he was doing.
Now, you said that you went to Essen, the Ruhr, Lorient and Milan.
Yes.
Which of those were the most dangerous, did you feel?
Of my operations, the most dangerous one would be the second flight to Berlin.
Why was that?
Because the operation was ill-judged by the people that ordered it. We bombed Berlin. That was 200 aircraft in total. We bombed Berlin in one night, and the raid was quite successful. Everything worked out as planned. We flew there. There was cloud cover the whole time on the ground. When we got to Berlin, the clouds had dispersed by the time we got there. We could see the target clearly, and the target was marked for us. This was in the early days of trying to get what became the Pathfinder for us, and they'd mark the target. We could see the markers, and it was just a matter of running in and bombing and leaving. The second operation we did the following night. But what we did, we followed exactly the same route to Berlin. We were sent the same way. That means flying out across Denmark, over the...